True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
On November 18th, 2012, 13-year-old Dylan Redwine traveled from his mother Elaine's house in Colorado Springs to visit his father Mark in Vallecito, Colorado, for a court-ordered visit. According to Dylan's big brother Corey, Dylan was not looking forward to visiting his father. A while back, Dylan had accidentally come across compromising and disturbing photos of his father. The photos disgusted him, and he planned to confront Mark. Mark Redwine picked up Dylan at the airport. On the way to Mark's house, they stopped at Walmart and picked up some fast food at McDonald's. Throughout his trip, Dylan had been communicating with his Durango friends and making plans to see them. Text messages indicated that Dylan tried to make plans to stay with a friend nearby rather than with his father. When Mark had said no to that plan, Dylan made plans to see his friend at 6:30 the next morning. Join us at the quiet end for Dylan Redwine's last visit. Dylan's last phone activity was at 9:37 p.m. on November 18th. He failed to show up at his friend's house the next morning. Mark claimed that Dylan was asleep on his couch when he left his home at 7:30 a.m. on the 19th. And when he returned at 11:30 a.m., Dylan was gone. As the last person to see his son alive, Mark Redwine was immediately a person of interest. Sigmund Freud once said, "I cannot think of any need in childhood as strong as the need for a father's protection." Not only did Mark Redwine fail to protect his son Dylan, he was the one who Dylan needed protection from. And today I have Dick with me, and he's brought a beer.
I have a beer from Colorado. This is from Oscar Blues Grill and Brew, called 1050 Bourbon Barrel Age. I seem to be on a stout run lately. Anyway, this is an American Imperial Stout. It's 12.5% alcohol by volume. Nice beer. It's black, small tan head, great aroma. You got some coffee, chocolate, a little bit of vanilla, and some bourbon. And that's exactly how it tastes. All those are perfectly arranged in tasting. This is what people call a thick, chewy beer, kind of viscous. So it's a heavy boy.
I love it when you describe a beer as chewy. There's just something about that.
It's not like you're going to really chew on it, but yeah, you get that sense.
It gives you that feeling, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's open it up. It sounds yum.
It is. It's very good.
All right, come on down here to the quiet end. And let's have a talk.
Okay. So Elaine and Mark Redwine were married in 1991. They had a son, Corey, in 1992, and then another son, Dylan, in 1999. The boys grew up in the picturesque mountains of Bayfield, Colorado, which is just outside the town of Durango. And when Dylan was young, he was very close to his father. Mark even spent some time as a stay-at-home dad. Dylan and Corey were best friends, even though there's a seven-year age difference between the two. They just did really well. Now, after many years of marriage, Elaine and Mark's relationship fell apart. They ended up getting divorced in 2007, and Elaine was given full custody of both boys. Now, Mark was allowed visitation, but after the divorce, he didn't spend much time with his sons. Or he may have only been allowed visitation and no shared custody because of an incident with his first wife. And when they were divorced, Mark took their son away from his mother for a couple of days.
So that's kind of scary that he would do that.
Sure is.
So in 2012, Elaine remarried. She and Dylan moved to Colorado Springs with her second husband, Michael Hall, in June. Corey stayed with his father for a couple more months until he moved to Colorado Springs as well that August. And Colorado Springs is just over 300 miles away from Bayfield. In August of 2012, Mark had taken Dylan on a trip to Boston, Then over Labor Day, Dylan went to visit Mark again. 1 week prior to Dylan's Thanksgiving visit, Mark sent an email to Elaine with Dylan's flight itinerary. And in the email, he said that Dylan was not responding to any of his texts. Mark had set up a personal bank account for Dylan, but Dylan's ATM card had never worked for him. And when Elaine asked Dylan why he wasn't answering his father's texts, Dylan told her, "There's really nothing to say." So he was really moving away from his father at that point.
Yeah, sounds like something was going on.
Yes. So Elaine responded to Mark's email suggesting that he make plans to do some activities with Dylan during this visit, because one of Dylan's biggest complaints about his visits with his father was that he just sat around the house and was really bored. Dylan had some old friends in nearby Durango, but none within walking distance of Mark's house. According to a court order, Dylan was supposed to spend the Thanksgiving holiday with his dad. He told his mom that he wanted to stay home and celebrate Thanksgiving in Colorado Springs with her. And Elaine was concerned, so she spoke to her attorney, asking if there was any way to avoid this visit. But she was told that she would be in violation of a court order, and she could very likely be held in contempt. Several of Dylan's friends were also aware that Dylan did not want to go visit his father. The night before his flight, he had a sleepover with some Colorado Springs friends, and they would later tell investigators that Dylan seemed afraid of his father and definitely did not want to go.
So there seems to be something more going on. I mean, you've already mentioned that Dylan had seen some compromising pictures of his father that kind of grossed him out. But now, according to his friends, he feared his father too. So looks like some stuff's going on between the two of them.
Absolutely, yes.
So Elaine picked up Dylan from the sleepover on the morning of the 18th of November and took him to the airport. And he had a backpack with him that held his cell phone, his iPod, a couple chargers, a hoodie, and other clothes. So as long as we got the cell phone, the iPod, and chargers, but we need to travel, right?
Well, that's the most important thing, yes.
So as Dylan walked away to board his plane, Elaine called him back for a hug. He ran back to her and hugged her before he said goodbye.
So that to me just seems like kind of a sweet moment, like he was being the big guy and going to get on the plane, and Mom said, "What, are you too big to give me a hug?" And he ran back, and she got that hug from him.
So and as Dylan was on his way to Durango, he sent a photo of the plane to a friend with the text, "What now?" The friend, Joseph Ceballos, took the text as a sign of how much Dylan was dreading the visit with his father. So then between 4:28 p.m. and 7:12 p.m., Dylan and his mother exchanged these texts.
Okay, so here, you be Dylan, I'll be Elaine.
Okay. I'm on the plane to Durango.
Oh, good. You did well, son. Proud of you. I love you, and thanks for keeping in touch so well. You're a flying pro. You land in Durango, son?
Just did.
Oh, good. I was worried. You're very late, but glad you're safe. Make Dad wait, LOL.
Yeah, after all of our waiting.
Did your dad get you, son?
Yes, with a frowny emoji.
I miss you already, but try and have fun.
We're starting off with a good time.
Yeah. Well, Mom knows that Dylan's not thrilled, and I'm sure there was a conversation about that that we're obviously not privy to.
I'm sure. So Mark picked up Dylan at the airport in Durango, which is about 30 minutes from Mark's house in Bayfield. On the way to Mark's house, the two stopped at Walmart. Store CCTV footage shows little interaction between Dylan and his father. Then after Walmart, they drove through a fast food restaurant and got some food. Mark said that when they got to his house, they tossed a Nerf football back and forth for a while. Then they watched a movie that Mark had purchased at Walmart. That was Adventureland. After they got to Mark's house, Dylan texted his friend Ryan Neva and asked if he could spend the night, which was okay with Ryan, but not okay with Dad. Mark said no. So Dylan made plans to go to Ryan's place early the next morning, like at 6:30. Then another friend of Dylan's, named Amanda Saxton, had been texting with Dylan that evening. He had texted her that he was watching Adventureland, but then he stopped responding to her texts. Mark said that he went to bed around 9:30 or 10, and he said that Dylan was still up when he went to bed, but he expected he would go to sleep soon after Mark went to bed. The last text by Dylan that night was at 9:37 p.m. Dylan's mom texted him at 10 p.m., "How are you, son? Doing okay?" But Dylan never responded, and no one ever talked to Dylan again.
So the next morning, Ryan texted Dylan at 6:46 a.m. asking where he was. Remember, Dylan was supposed to be at Ryan's house at 6:30. Mark Redwine would say that he woke up at 5:45 a.m. on the 19th. He was planning to take Dylan to Ryan's. He said that he kept busy around the house and got ready for the day, and then at 7:30, he said he tried to wake Dylan up. Dylan was asleep on the couch, which was where he normally slept when he was visiting, but according to Mark, Dylan didn't want to get up, so Mark left the house without him and went to his office to meet with his employer. He had to pick up a paycheck or something. Mark's cell phone records show that he texted Dylan 4 times that day. At 8:14 a.m., he wrote, "Hey, bud, out of the office, call me." 1 minute later, he texted, "Call me, please." Then, at 11:23 a.m., Mark texted, "Dill, I'm home and you're nowhere to be found. Come back so I can get you to Bayfield. At least call me, okay?" Then, at 2:33 in the afternoon, Mark texted, "Dylan, you need to call me. Where are you?" So according to Mark, he got home around 11:30 a.m. Dylan wasn't there, but Mark didn't think too much of it and wasn't concerned. He said he took a nap then. Then at about 2:30, when Dylan didn't respond to his texts, Mark went to Ryan's house, but Dylan wasn't there. He remembered that he hadn't seen Dylan's fishing pole, so he checked down by the lake to see if Dylan had gone fishing. Dylan wasn't anywhere around the lake. Mark then drove to the house of another friend of Dylan's, Fernando Stubbs, but he hadn't seen or heard from Dylan either. During the time Mark was sending texts to Dylan, cell tower data would show that Mark drove from his house to Durango and then back to his home. He also called Dylan's phone 7 times. After that, he never called or texted Dylan again. But Ryan Nava was growing more concerned about his friend as time passed. He hadn't heard from him. "Dude, your dad's looking for you," he texted Dylan. When Dylan's mother, Elaine, called Ryan to see if Dylan had been with him, Ryan moved from concerned to alarmed. His last text to Dylan read, "Dude, you need to call someone as soon as possible. We're all worried about you."
Yeah, there's multiple people looking for him. He's out there somewhere, not answering.
Yes. Now, Mark went to the marshal's office to report Dylan missing, and he sent a text to Elaine at 4:32 p.m. as she was driving home from work. "Elaine, I was wondering if you've heard from Dylan. I've been trying to reach him all afternoon." So this just made her heart drop to hear from her ex when she's 300 miles away, that he doesn't know where her son is. She was just frantic. So she called up her 20-year-old son, Corey, and told him that Mark could not find Dylan. When she got home, she told her husband what was going on. Then she made plans to drive to Vallecito, and that's about a 7-hour drive away. She went home, packed a bag, got in her car, ready to head out. Then she texted Mark, "It's really worrying when I'm 7 hours away and get a message like this from you. I haven't heard from Dylan today. Where did you leave him or last see him?" And Mark answered, "I went to town for errands and he was fine. I'm just concerned and thought you may have heard from him." Elaine then asked Mark if he was at the Vallecito house, and she told him she was very concerned. "Please let me know when you find him," she texted. And they exchanged a few more texts. She told Mark that they should tell the police, and he told her he was just leaving the Bayfield Marshal's office.
Oh, good. He's doing what he should be doing.
Yes, but he said he already went, and he really didn't go until after he called her, or texted her.
Yeah.
I don't think they were really on speaking terms at all.
Yeah, it sounds like they don't do well together. So Elaine's husband, Michael, and her older son, Corey, decided to go with Elaine to look for Dylan in Vallecito. At 5:40 p.m., Elaine texted Mark and asked if he had heard from Dylan yet. Then she texted that she had called the marshal's office, and they had no record of him calling them. Oops, he's busted there. Mark didn't respond. Then at 6:23, she texted him again. and he wrote back that he hadn't heard from Dylan yet. He wrote that he'd just left one of Dylan's friends' houses and is waiting for the sheriff to call him back. He wrote that he's doing everything he could, and he would let her know the moment he heard anything. So Elaine texted Mark, "I am so suspect of you now. How could he just disappear? He wouldn't just leave. He would have called me." And Mark, the fine man he is, texted back at 6:34, "It's just like you to blame me. Right now, the best thing for him is finding him." Then at 7:08, he wrote, "I just spoke with the deputy. His fishing pole is missing. The deputy's on his way up. He asked that I search the property, which I will do now. I know this is difficult, but we gotta believe he's okay."
Well, Lane continued to call Dylan's phone and get no answer. A deputy and a canine were sent to Mark Redwine's house, along with an officer from the sheriff's department. The deputy knocked on the front door, and Mark did answer right away. The deputy would later say that Mark's appearance was disheveled and rough, like he'd been drinking or was tired. He looked very unkempt. He observed numerous empty liquor bottles both inside and outside of the residence, and he described Mark as calm and nonchalant.
What do you think with all those liquor bottles?
Oh, I think he had a drinking problem.
Yeah, because, I mean, he couldn't have gone through that many in the short time since Dylan went missing.
Right. So. No, I think there was an ongoing drinking problem.
Okay.
Absolutely. The deputy asked for something of Dylan's that could be used as a scent article for dogs, and Mark said there was nothing. He said that Dylan had taken all of his things with him. So that was strange, and the deputy looked around. He asked if Dylan had slept on the couch because he saw some pillows and bedding on it, and Mark said yes. So the deputy got Mark's permission to take the pillow from the couch. Now, a pillow where the subject had slept was usually a very good scent article for the dogs, but that day the dogs were not able to pick up a scent from it. So this led to suspicions that Dylan had not slept on that pillow at all, and that Mark had possibly cleaned up the house after killing his son. So that's a very scary thought.
Well, I think the fact that the dogs couldn't pick up a scent from the pillow says a lot.
Yes, and why wouldn't there even be like a toothbrush or a chapstick or anything? A dish that he'd eaten off of in the morning or a glass, you know? It's very odd that he said there was nothing.
Nothing.
So on that night, November 19th, the police set up a search headquarters across the street from Mark's house. They were surprised that Mark didn't come over and that he didn't ask about the search or offer to help in any way, as most parents would have in this type of situation. And then at 11 p.m., all the lights in his house went out, including the front porch light. You know, like Mark just went to bed for the night, it seemed.
Yeah, turning in for the night.
First, it's very odd that he would be able to sleep. And normally when someone goes missing, the family will keep all of the lights on to serve as kind of a beacon to the lost person. Mark lived in a very dark, secluded area, so it's very odd. Now, when Mark came out the next morning, he didn't approach anyone or ask anyone how the search was going. Instead, what he did was he sat in a folding lawn chair out front of his house and sipped a cup of coffee. Then the search for Dylan became more involved the following day. Mark's first ex-wife, Betsy Horvath, called the police and expressed some concerns that Mark may have done something to Dylan. She reported that Mark had previously said that if he ever had to get rid of a body, he would leave it out in the mountains. She also told them that during their divorce and custody case, Mark repeatedly violated the custody agreement and told her that he would kill the kids before he would let her have them. Now, they had two sons together also. Her sister had heard this threat and confirmed what Betsy had told them. So we have two people confirming that. I guess an ex-wife isn't always the best person because she could have her own motives.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But she seemed very genuine.
Well, and she has a backup.
Yep.
Of course, you could say, well, she's your family, so she's going to lie anyway. But
yeah, but I still think having a second person helps, regardless of who it is.
No question.
So during the time of Dylan's disappearance, Mark and Elaine were still involved in a contested custody case over Dylan. Mark told the police that he had left a contempt of court accusation out on his kitchen table where Dylan may have seen it. So apparently he was implying that this could have upset Dylan and caused him to run away. That's the only way I know how to take that.
Yeah, I think that's how you have to take it.
Yeah.
At least from Mark's point of view. And over the past several months, Dylan had been saying that he didn't want to visit his dad, and he is just very uncomfortable being around him. Now, it was in 2011 when Dylan had come across some compromising pictures of Mark Redwine on his laptop computer. He had been just shocked and disgusted, and he had shown the pictures to his brother Corey while Mark was sleeping in a hotel during a road trip. Corey had taken pictures of the photos from the laptop screen. And later, Dylan asked Corey to send him the photos so he could confront his father with them. He's really focused on these photos.
Well, yeah. It's a big deal.
So the search continued. On November 24th, Officer Kevin Brown was part of the search of a nearby dam when he saw Mark's vehicle drive by with a woman driving and Mark in the passenger seat. So Officer Brown decided to follow them. When they pulled over, Brown pulled up beside them and told them about the search. There were dive teams searching the lake, and Brown invited him to the area. Mark said he was thinking about it overnight, and he wanted to check the ditches in Bayfield along the roads. He said, well, maybe I'll swing by the dam later, but he never did. And later, Brown went to Mark's house, but Mark didn't ask any questions about how the search had gone. So he's really concerned about his son.
Well, yes, and I think Brown was very concerned that Mark was involved in this. When he went to see Mark, he purposely didn't mention anything about the search, just waiting for Mark to ask, and Mark never did.
And he just didn't. Yeah.
No. Mark's house was searched on November 29th. By now, Mark was the only person of interest, and the police were convinced that Dylan had not run away. The crime scene unit was at the residence, and they used luminol to test for the presence of blood. In Mark's living room, the luminol glowed on the couch, love seat, on the floor beneath the carpet, and on the coffee table.
Huh, well.
So there's no blood on the carpet itself. It's as if someone put the rug over the floor after cleaning up blood.
Yeah.
And there was also some on the coffee table, a couple spots. So samples were taken for testing. And at least one of the samples was later identified as a DNA match for Dylan Redwine. So if you've been listening to the show for a while, you probably know that we're obsessed with playing Best Fiends. In my humble but correct opinion, it's the best match 3 style game by far. The rest are basically the same game with just different color schemes. So come on, guys, stop crushing that same old candy and try a puzzle game with something fresh to offer.
With Best Fiends, you play through an actual storyline, complete with good guys, which are the fiends, and the not-so-good guys. Those are the slugs.
Boo, hiss.
Your fiends start off as wee baby versions of their future selves. And the more you play, the more fiends join your team, and the more powerful they become, helping you to solve increasingly challenging puzzles as you progress through the game.
Well, I just love Best Fiends. It's action-packed, brain-boosting, and with new content added constantly, you never get bored. Not to brag, but I'm now at level 574, way past Dickie here.
Are you cheap?
No, I don't. There's no concern about running out of levels either, because there are literally thousands of levels with more still being added all of the time. Playing Best Fiends just fits so well into any lifestyle. You can binge play for hours or just pick it up for a round or two while you're waiting in line or chilling out on the couch.
Best Fiends really is the perfect thing for a little pick-me-up and a fresh challenge. Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
In February of 2013, about 3 months since Dylan's disappearance, Elaine, Corey, and Mark Redwine went on the Dr. Phil show. Mark and Elaine targeted accusations at each other, and Mark said that when he returned home from errands on November 19th, he saw the TV was still on Nickelodeon, which he thought was Dylan's favorite channel. But Elaine said that Dylan definitely did not run away and it didn't make sense that he wasn't answering texts from her or any of his friends. Also, Dylan didn't watch Nickelodeon anymore. He watched MTV. Elaine said that Mark didn't even know his own son. Mark suggested that Dylan had gone fishing because the pole was missing. But Elaine and Corey said that Dylan didn't know how to fish by himself. He hadn't learned how to tie a lure yet. And it didn't make sense that Dylan had taken all of his belongings if he had left the house on his own. Absolutely nothing belonging to Dylan had been found in Mark's home. Not a toothbrush or a piece of clothing, nothing.
So it's like he had never been there.
Yeah, maybe that's how Mark wanted it to be.
Possibly. On Dr. Phil, Elaine said that her biggest fear was that Dylan was no longer alive.
Well, of course. She must be really upset by this point.
And then Mark said, well, Elaine must have had some help in abducting Dylan from his house. And Elaine said, yeah, that's bullshit.
Well, and who would believe that?
Well, we're on Dr. Phil. We got to have some drama, right?
Right.
Elaine wanted her son, and she wanted Mark to tell her where he was. Of course, by this time, Elaine feared that Mark had done something to Dylan. Mark told Dr. Phil that Elaine called her divorce attorney when he told her that Dylan was missing. Elaine said that's not true. She said she believed Mark knew more than he was saying and that Dylan had not run away. She pointed out that he had nothing to run away from, and if he had left Mark's, he would have called her.
Well, yeah, I could see why he might have run away from his father's house, but he would have contacted his mom or Corey, or at least his friends.
Or friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't just run away without a plan.
No, and Elaine said right on the show that Dylan was a frequent texter. It didn't make any sense at all that he'd stop texting her and his friends.
Yeah, well, that's the concern, right?
Absolutely. Mark denied having any involvement in Dylan's disappearance and claimed that he was not the last person to see his son. He said that his mail carrier, Angie, told him that she had seen a boy who resembled Dylan on the afternoon of November 19th, 2012, the day that Dylan was reported missing. And we'll get back to that.
Okay.
That's really just a big nothing. Now, Mark's first wife, Betsy, came on the show, along with Brandon, one of her sons with Mark. Betsy said that in the past, she had feared that Mark would take their two children, Brandon and Mark Allen, and hide them away from her. She says she believed he may have had something to do with Dylan's disappearance. There are just so many questions, and the stories keep changing, and that's why people are looking at you, she told Mark. Mark denied that his story had changed. Brandon said he thought his father should have been doing more to help find Dylan. It has crossed my mind that Mark is hiding Dylan or has harmed him, Brandon said. All I can say is, I hope he's safe.
So Elaine and Mark's oldest son, Corey, said that he believes Mark, who he refused to call Dad, was paying someone to hide Dylan. I do believe that Mark took Dylan to punish my mom and essentially hurt her, he said. I think Mark has been lying from the start. Corey told Dr. Phil that he'll never have a relationship with his father. After this, Mark is gone from my life forever, he said.
So initially, Mark said that he would take a polygraph for Dr. Phil. But in the end, he said that, well, maybe it wasn't the right time for him to be taking a polygraph.
Well, he's not lawyered up yet, is he?
I don't think so, no. But Dr. Phil did have a polygraph expert there, ready to go.
Yeah, but if he had a lawyer, there wouldn't have been any discussion at all about the polygraph.
Right. Well, no, I think that when it was initially brought up, just to sound good, he said, of course I'll take it.
Oh, sure.
But then once it became a reality, he wasn't going to do it.
Yeah, I got nothing to hide. I'll take that lie detector test.
Easy to say.
Easy to say.
Now, after the Dr. Phil appearances, the La Plata County Sheriff's Department issued the following statement. The investigation for locating Dylan Redwine is still open, ongoing, and active. We've even had investigators from out of state this week following up on tips. The frustrating part is that we are not much farther along than where we were early on in this investigation because of the total lack of clues left behind. It has been a criminal investigation from the first evening that Dylan was reported missing. Within the first few days, we were working closely with the FBI And within the first week, we assembled a task force comprised of local, state, and federal agencies. This task force is still currently in place and pursuing the investigation. We have not identified anyone as a person of interest or as a suspect during the entire investigation. Now, they said that, but everyone knew that Mark was being looked at. His behavior was not normal.
Yeah.
He just didn't seem like a grieving, worried father.
There's so much stuff in Mark's actions that point a finger at him.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
who else is going to be a suspect?
I know. But then in June 2013, authorities announced that Dylan's partial remains were found near the Viecito Reservoir in southwestern Colorado. A cause of death couldn't be determined, but homicide was identified as the manner of death, and a criminal investigation was ongoing. The search had extended out to Middle Mountain Road. First, a shoe was found, and it was identified as Dylan's by his mother, Elaine. Then they found a sock, black earbuds, a shredded piece of shirt, and three human bones. Dylan had been found, and Elaine's worst fear had come true. His remains were found scattered. It wasn't until November 2015, 2 years later, when two hikers found Dylan's skull 1.5 miles away from those first scattered remains.
Been some animals at work here.
Yes, and there's also the thought that the body was not discarded in one piece, unfortunately.
Oh.
I know. Don't want to think about that.
On July 22, 2017, Mark Redwine was finally arrested. At this time, he was working as a long-haul trucker in Washington State. He was pulled over, arrested, and charged with his son's murder. He acted as if he had no idea why he was being arrested. Mark was charged with second-degree murder and child abuse resulting in death. But Mark would not go on trial until almost 9 years after Dylan's disappearance and 4 years after his arrest.
Well, according to the indictment, Mark had previously reacted violently when Dylan's older brother, Corey, had a conversation with him about the compromising photos in early 2012. Corey called for justice in his brother's death in November 2020 and wrote on Facebook, "Dylan needs strength from more than just us, and I can't begin to explain how much every single person that knows his story is part of that. Every day a kid is forgotten by the legal system, and that is not okay."
So then, after several delays, Mark's trial began in July of this year, 2021. At the trial, in his opening statement, the prosecutor told the jury that Mark was the last person to see Dylan alive on November 18, 2012. He said that Mark killed his son that evening. He told the jury that Dylan's blood was found in Mark's living room, and that a cadaver dog had indicated at the back of Mark's truck. He said that Mark and Dylan did not have a good relationship, and that Dylan had found compromising photos of his father, and he had confronted his father about them. And that is what led Mark to kill his youngest son in a rage.
Mark's defense attorney said in his opening statements that Dylan had left his father's house alone on the morning of November 19th and never returned. He said that the one essential question was whether Dylan would have left his father's house on the 19th while his father was off at work. And he said that the answer was yes. After Dylan left, he said, he succumbed to the elements and evidence would show that his body had been damaged by animals and that his father Mark was not involved in any way. The defense said that they had a witness who had reported seeing Dylan later that day walking with someone else. In response to Dylan's blood being found in Mark's living room, the defense claimed that it was such a small amount that it could have come from a sore or a skinned knee. So, the defense said that Mark was clearly innocent, and going through all this, he'd lost everything. So, basically saying, well, you know, Mark's the real victim here. Not a popular stance.
No, it's not going to go far.
No.
So Ryan Nava, Dylan's best friend in Bayfield, was the first to take the stand. He testified that in 2012, he was 13 years old, and that he and Dylan talked almost every day. Then after Dylan had moved to Colorado Springs, Ryan said he came back on occasion to stay with his dads and visit his friends. Mark lived about 20 miles away from where Ryan lived. So he told the jury that Dylan would never have tried to walk to his house. He spoke about the one and only time when he, Dylan, and another friend hitchhiked. It was during a blizzard, and the boys were not properly dressed for the weather. So they were joking about hitchhiking, but then an elderly man pulled over and offered to drive them up the road. The man allowed the boys to ride in the flatbed of his pickup, and he drove them just a few hundred feet up the road and dropped them off. So the defense was trying to paint a picture of Dylan as someone who had hitchhiked on multiple occasions and was comfortable with it. Ryan, however, said that he had never known Dylan to hitchhike before or after that one time, and he'd never talked about doing it ever again. Then Ryan's texts with Dylan from November 18th were shown in court. They had made plans that day to hang out that night and for Dylan to spend the night with Ryan at his grandmother's house. But at 6:57 p.m., Dylan texted that he couldn't come. Ryan said, okay. And at 7:09, Ryan texted Dylan again, asking why. And Dylan answered, IDK. And Ryan then asked, did your dad say no? And Dylan answered, yeah. So then they made plans for Dylan to go and see Ryan the next morning at 6:30.
So from that, it just seems like Dylan was clearly desperate to get away from his father's house. He's just gotten there for the visit, and he's already tried two separate times to get out of there. Two separate plans. So he clearly did not want to be there with his father.
No, he did not.
So, of course, Dylan didn't show up the next morning at Ryan's, and Ryan never heard from him again. Ryan said that he saw Mark Redwine that afternoon when he was at another friend's house. Mark came over there, and he said he was looking for Dylan. Mark asked if they had seen Dylan, and no one had. So Ryan was worried, and then he tried to reach Dylan, but he got no response. Other friends of Dylan testified about how they saw Dylan's relationship with his father. His friends from the sleepover Dylan had been at in Colorado Springs before he left for his visit to see his father testified that Dylan had not wanted to go, and that he actually seemed afraid to be alone with his father. They said that Dylan had said he was mandated by a court order to go and see his dad. Corey by this time was 20 years old, so he didn't have to go. The prosecution showed surveillance footage from the airport and from Walmart showing Dylan's last night alive. He was wearing a black t-shirt, black shorts, and a white cap. In the Walmart video from about 6:30 p.m., Mark is seen in the drink aisle while Dylan was in the electronics department.
So Elaine testified about her marriage to and her divorce from Mark. She described what kind of person Dylan had been. Fun, friendly, empathetic, and energetic. He loved sports. He was quick to make friends. She spoke about the last time she had seen Dylan at the airport. Then on cross-examination, she was asked about a protest that took place outside Mark's house after she arrived in Bayfield. She said she hadn't planned it, but she did attend it with her son Corey. When asked if she had told many people that Mark was responsible for Dylan's disappearance, she said she wasn't sure that she'd said that, but she believed Mark was the last person to see Dylan, and he was not helping to find him or answering questions.
Well, Lane was asked if she was aware of the compromising photos that Dylan had found of his father, and she said that she was. Corey had actually shown her the photos. She said that Dylan had been devastated when he saw the photos. He found them humiliating, and after that, he lost respect for his father. The prosecution pointed out that those compromising photos were at the heart of the motive for Mark killing his son. Dylan was so disturbed by the photos that it changed the relationship. The prosecution believed that Dylan had confronted his father on the night of November 18th, and that Mark had killed Dylan in a rage.
So Dylan's brother Corey testified to what was in the photos. Four photos were shown to the jury, with instructions that the photos were admitted for a limited purpose. The jury was told that the photos were not being admitted to prove that the defendant had a bad moral character. They were only being admitted to allow the prosecution to attempt to prove that the defendant became violently enraged when confronted by others concerning his sexual preference, and to allow the prosecution to attempt to explain the deteriorating relationship between the defendant and Dylan.
So Corey told the court that in 2011, he and Dylan went with their father on a road trip across the country. They were going to car races and baseball games. A few times during the trip, Mark would leave and Corey and Dylan would hang out together. Then one time when Mark was asleep, Dylan was using Mark's computer when he came across pictures of Mark. In these pictures, Mark was dressed in women's lingerie and he was wearing an adult diaper. In these photos, Mark was eating the feces that was in the diaper. Corey said that Dylan was so disgusted by the photos that he had trouble containing himself. Dylan was 12 when this happened. Corey told the jury that finding these photos made Dylan lose any reason he had to look up to his father. Corey took photos of the pictures on his cell phone. In August 2012, Dylan and Mark went on a trip to Boston. At this point, Corey wasn't getting along with Mark, so he didn't go along. Corey said that each time he talked to Dylan, Dylan complained about Mark. Then one time he texted Corey, and he asked him to send him the photos so he could confront Mark with them. Corey said that Dylan asked for the photos about 7 times, but Corey didn't send them to him at that time because he was worried about him confronting Mark while they were alone together on this trip. The prosecution played a portion of the Dr. Phil show where Mark claimed to have planted the photos just to get a rise out of his sons. But then Corey testified when the photos were found, he and Dylan were getting along just fine with Mark, so there was no reason to plant any disturbing pictures on his computer.
Yeah, that sounds like such a wimpy, poor excuse.
I know. It's very unbelievable. Who would believe that?
I don't know.
It's total nonsense.
So Corey described his last interaction with his little brother Dylan. He saw him at his mom's house before they left for the airport on November 18th, 2012. He said that Dylan was anxious and didn't want to go. The two brothers joked, and Corey said, "Well, don't have too much fun." And Dylan just rolled his eyes at Corey.
So it was understood that Dylan didn't want to go. Didn't want to be with his dad.
That's quite clear.
Yes. So after that, Corey testified about the time after Dylan had gone missing and how Mark didn't seem like he wanted to even help in the search. He said that when he, his mom, and his stepdad arrived in town after learning that Dylan was missing, he tried to get in touch with Mark. Searches were underway, but Mark was not participating, and he was very difficult to get a hold of. His lack of effort to find Dylan really angered Corey. Then, in the June search, when some of Dylan's belongings and remains were found, Mark was nowhere to be found. Corey, Elaine, and Elaine's husband Mike were there for the search, but Mark, who lived just 8 miles from the search area, did not attend and did not offer to help in any way. Really showed no reaction at all. But then after Dylan's items were identified, Mark did attend a candlelight vigil. So that was very big of him to do that.
It was. Nice thing to do.
Yep.
So Elaine's divorce attorney testified about the divorce and custody case between Elaine and Mark. She said that Dylan had told her he wanted to live with his mom. And she actually broke down crying on the stand when she spoke about telling Elaine that she had to send Dylan to his Thanksgiving visit in 2012, or she could be in contempt of court.
Yeah, I think she really held a lot of guilt over that, certainly. Carrie Cochran testified that she'd been living next door to Mark Redwine in 2012. Her house was approximately 100 yards from his. And she recalled the night of November 18th, 2012, the night Dylan had arrived to visit with his father. She said she got up around 2 a.m. to use the bathroom. and on her way back to bed, as was kind of her habit, she peeked out of her window. That's when she noticed the porch light was on at Mark's house. According to her, every night for months, up to that night, Mark's house had been completely dark. And then, between 6:30 and 7 a.m., when she got up for the day, the light was off. So a little unusual, like there was some kind of activity that night at the house.
Yeah, possibly. To me, that doesn't help too much.
Well, I don't think it was groundbreaking testimony, but it was just another little grain of salt to add to the jar.
And a woman named Kathy Berry testified that she had met Elaine during a search for Dylan, and they had become good friends. And after Dylan's remains were found, she said that Elaine received a text message from Mark saying that he hoped that her friend Kat, who had colon cancer, would die. This was very upsetting, especially since they had just gotten the bad news about Dylan.
Who says something like that?
I don't know.
The scumbag. That's not something you say.
So Kathy and Kat decided at that point, let's go to Mark's house and confront him about what he had said. So they pulled up to his house and they saw him at the front door in his underwear. She said something to him about eating shit, and he came toward the woman. They were screaming at him, and he picked up a log and yelled at them, coming at them in a rage, as if to hit them over their heads with the log. Two women got back in their car and drove off. Probably a good idea.
Well, yeah, they were really afraid that he was going to hit one of them, or at least the car. She described his rage as like his eyes bulging out, almost like a cartoon character. And he's in his underwear. Why is he out there in his underwear? There has to be some alcohol abuse going on here, in addition to all the other problems he apparently had.
Well, something's going on, that's for sure.
Yes. Sergeant Daniel Abdella from the Bayfield Marshal's office testified that around 5 p.m. on November 19th, Mark showed up at the side door of the Marshal's office and knocked. Mark asked him if he had seen his son when he was out on patrol that day. Now, the sergeant was confused. He hadn't heard of a missing child. He didn't know who Mark was talking about. And Mark hadn't brought a photo of Dylan with him. And then he said he didn't want an ATL, which is an attempt to locate, done, which would have put out the information to all of law enforcement to be looking for Dylan. The sergeant even explained to Mark what an ATL was, but Mark declined. This was very unusual. Normally, parents of a missing child are nervous and anxious to have an ATL done immediately. But Mark was calm and did not want that done.
Yeah. Why?
Why indeed?
Uh-huh.
Sean Boris, a co-worker of Mark's, testified that on the morning of November 19th, Mark showed up looking very haggard and tired. Sean was surprised that Dylan was not with Mark. Michael Hall, Elaine's husband and Corey and Dylan's stepdad, testified that he came into town with Corey and Elaine to search for Dylan. He said that Mark only participated in one search near the lake. Mark did not participate in any of the searches up on Middle Mountain Road, where Dylan's remains were ultimately found. Michael said that days before those searches, he was driving in the Middle Mountain Road area when he pulled over to pour out some old coffee from his travel cup. Then he saw Mark driving down Middle Mountain Road in his white pickup. It appeared to Michael that Mark was trying to avoid him. Michael tried to follow him and had to speed in order to catch up with Mark. Michael followed him to an intersection, and then he turned the other way. But Michael wanted to see if Mark would return to the area. So Michael put up cameras on the road, and then he shared the footage with law enforcement to show that Mark had gone out to that area. He wasn't there for the searches, but he was going out there on his own, almost in a secret type of way.
Yeah.
So that's another very suspicious thing.
Jed Botsford of the U.S. Forest Service testified about the Middle Mountain Road area, saying that when the gate on the road was closed, it could be bypassed with an ATV. Another officer testified that Corey, Michael, and Elaine were investigated and eliminated as suspects. She also said that in November 2016, two hikers came across Dylan's skull. One of the hikers testified that the skull was found in a spot that looked like an animal den. He said that he dropped the skull about 1 or 2 feet from where he had found it. And after they returned home, they called the police. The next day, they went back with investigators to recover the skull.
Yeah, and it actually ended up taking them a couple days to find it. So the hikers maybe didn't know exactly where they'd been, which it's hard to tell when you're out in the wilderness.
Oh, no kidding.
Deputy Goldbright testified that Mark voluntarily turned over Dylan's fishing pole to them in July 2013. Now, this is after he'd been saying that it was missing ever since Dylan disappeared. Mark had said repeatedly that he had searched the house and the garage, but he claimed to have found it in the garage right after Dylan's remains had been found off of Middle Mountain Road. So up until then, Mark had repeatedly said that the pole was missing, and the police had been searching around the lake area based on the tip that Dylan may have gone off fishing on his own and something happened to him. So it was suspicious how he found that pole. Another really suspicious thing about that is that several deputies and FBI agents had been in Mark's garage more than once, and they had not seen Dylan's fishing pole. The deputy also said that when she searched Mark's truck, she found Dylan's flight itinerary and debit card. She said that in August of 2016, she received notification that Mark was seen throwing away a bunch of things in a dumpster. So when they went to the location, they found photos of Dylan and his mother, Elaine. She also said that deputies had not notified the coroner after they found Dylan's remains, and they didn't close off that area. And this is because they weren't sure if the remains were human at first. Although clearly they should have done that anyway.
Yes.
So that was an oversight.
Then there's another interesting witness, and this is biologist Dr. Heather Johnson. She had done a study in the area on black bears. So she testified that in the winter of 2012, bear hibernations had begun on October 10th, with the last one observed on November 13th. So by November 19th, it was highly unlikely that any bears would be awake. Also, she said that the bears are not very active in the weeks leading up to hibernation. She told the court that there had been only 4 fatalities from bear attacks since 1900. When asked if it was likely that a bear could move a 13-year-old child 1.5 miles away, she said, "That is very unlikely. They may move a kill, but like several yards, not 1.5 miles.
Right, exactly. No, Dylan was 105 pounds. It's not an infant.
Right.
Dr. Diane France is a forensic anthropologist who testified about her examination of Dylan's skull. She said that it had a skull fracture from blunt force trauma, which had happened around the time of Dylan's death. She also talked about 2 straight lines on Dylan's cranium that had been made with a knife or a sharp tool, not an animal tooth. She explained that a knife or a tool would leave a V-shaped groove in the bone, but an animal tooth would leave more of a U-shaped groove. Now, they did have someone for the defense giving another opinion on this, and he had said that the lines on his skull could have been from growth. Do you have any opinion on that?
Yeah, it's virtually impossible to be due to growth.
Right, these weren't fissures.
No.
Mark's older son from his first marriage, Brandon, testified about calling Mark in June of 2013 after he learned that Dylan's remains had been found. He said they talked for about an hour, but Mark didn't seem upset. He wasn't acting any different than usual. Mark had told him that he thought Dylan may have been shot by hunters. Then Mark brought up blunt force trauma several times during the call, but this was before Dylan's skull had been found. Brandon remembered saying to his wife, "He's telling me what happened." So after the call, Brandon emailed the police with his concerns. On cross-examination, Brandon acknowledged that Mark had said he loved Dylan and that Mark had actually handed out some business cards to people asking them to call him if they saw Dylan. However, he did have flyers in his car one time when they were driving around, and Mark had not bothered to hang up one flyer.
Yeah.
Then an FBI agent testified about phone records. He said that 8:07 p.m. on November 18th was Dylan's last outgoing communication on his cell phone, and it pinged off of the tower serving Mark's house. This is the same tower that serves the Middle Mountain Road area. There was no further activity on his phone after 9:56 p.m., meaning that the phone had been destroyed, turned off, or the battery had died. Remember, his mom had texted him at 10 p.m. and never gotten a response. So the phone was probably destroyed or off by that point. As for Mark's phone, it had called Dylan's phone on November 19th 7 times and texted him 4 times. Then on the 20th, he tried to call Dylan's phone just after 7 a.m., and that was it. He never tried to contact Dylan again. Dylan's last Facebook post was on November 18th at 8:31 p.m. Typically, Dylan would post on Facebook every day up until about 11 p.m. But there was no activity on his computer after 10 p.m. on November 18th. Canine Search Solutions founder Karen Cochran Gumman testified about what her dog Molly alerted on at Mark Redwine's property. She said that Molly alerted near the garage. Inside the house, Molly alerted 7 times. She also alerted at the back of Mark's pickup truck. Mark had written a narrative of what had happened on November 18th and 19th at the request of the FBI. In this narrative, Mark said that he and Dylan had been roughhousing and tossing a football back and forth after they got to his house on the 18th, but he said no one had been hurt.
When interviewing Mark 2 days later at the FBI office, the agent told Mark about finding blood in his house. This was when Mark said Dylan had had a cold sore on his lip, which was oozing blood. First time anyone's mentioned this. Now, the agent then told Mark that a cold sore would be very easy to verify by talking to Elaine and a flight attendant. So when Mark heard that, he changed his mind and said that when they were tossing the football, the ball had hit Dylan in the face, causing him to bleed.
Now remember, this was supposedly a Nerf football, which wouldn't do that anyway.
Right.
But just changing his mind from the cold sore is terribly incriminating.
Well, that's a huge red flag.
Oh, sure. I mean,
yeah, he's come up thinking, oh, I got this excuse for the blood there.
Yeah.
And then they say, well, we can verify this with the flight attendant or his mother. And he figures, well, that's not going to happen, is it? So I better change my story.
Cold sores don't bleed much. And what would he have done? He'd pick up the rug, wipe his cold sore on the floor, and then put the rug down again?
Yeah. So the FBI agent then talked with Mark about the possibilities of what had happened to Dylan. They both agreed that a stranger abduction was unlikely, and he probably did not run away. Then the possibility of a wild animal getting Dylan came up. The agent said a bear, maybe, and at that point, Mark really got revved up about the idea.
Yeah, so most parents would not get excited about a bear possibly killing their child. But Mark seemed to like this idea. It seemed like a way out for him,
it's
really.
A way out, yeah.
Yeah.
The agent then told Mark that it was likely an accident and he needed to cooperate. And at that point, Mark seemed to slump forward and he said, got to think about myself.
So what the hell does that mean? How would you take that?
I would take that to mean that he's not going to confess.
Right, that he's going to think about what is right for him, for
yeah,
himself. Yes.
For himself.
Terrible.
Yeah, and that ended the interview.
Well, the defense had a forensic biologist testify about DNA samples that she had tested. She said that in February of 2020, the defense team had asked her to analyze a beer can, which had been found near the scene where Dylan's remains were first found. She testified that the DNA on the can belonged to a man, and she was able to rule out Mark Redwine as the source. Angela Lee also testified for the defense. She said that she used to work as a postal carrier. She said that she had seen Mark and Dylan outside of Mark's house every once in a while. She said that on November 19, 2012, she saw two boys walking while she was on her route. That day, she said she saw those two boys walking down the road and she glanced at them, and one reminded her of Dylan. But she also said she wasn't really paying attention. She couldn't be sure that the boy even was Dylan. So that's pretty useless and gives me the picture of a very desperate defense team. We already know that eyewitness testimony is shaky at best, and this is not even someone who's sure.
Yeah, well, Mark presented her as identifying Dylan.
Yeah, sure he did. That's what he wanted it to see.
The likelihood is that it wasn't.
Well, I think we all know it wasn't. It's pretty clear from all the other evidence it wasn't.
And she said that herself.
Yeah, she didn't really believe it either.
No.
In closing arguments, the prosecutor described Mark and Dylan's relationship as deteriorating. Mark was angry and frustrated over this, the prosecutor said. He said, "Don't forget that this case is about a 13-year-old boy who was killed and will never have a future." He reminded the jury about the blood in Mark's house. He said that Mark had killed and dismembered Dylan before scattering his remains off of Middle Mountain Road, putting the skull with the blunt trauma evidence further away from the rest. He also pointed out Mark's behavior after the murder. He was just so evasive and misleading. Then he threw away photos of Dylan, and he took all of the money from Dylan's bank account. He also pointed out the lack of activity on Dylan's phone since that evening.
And the defense told the jury that the evidence didn't support the state's theory that Mark had killed Dylan. The defense attorney called it thin and speculative. He said that the amount of blood in the living room was very small and certainly not indicative of murder by blunt force trauma or the dismemberment of a body.
Well, once the case went to the jury, they deliberated for just over 3 hours before they reached their verdict. Not a good sign for the defense.
Nope.
Mark was found guilty on all counts. So he will be sentenced next month, October 2021. Because he was convicted of second-degree murder, he isn't eligible for the death penalty. Second-degree murder is a Class 2 felony in Colorado, and he's facing a minimum of 8 years and a maximum of 48 years in prison with 5 years parole. Both Corey Redwine and his mother Elaine told local reporters that they're hopeful they can finally move on now and remember Dylan's life instead of focusing on his horrible death. "I'll remember Dylan for what he was when he was alive," Corey Redwine said. "How bright and how powerful he was as a young child. These 9 years have been focused on his death, and it's a complete misrepresentation of who Dylan really was." Elaine said, "There are so many emotions right now. I've cried, I've been mad. Right now I'm just ready to start remembering Dylan and his story, rather than the gruesome details of his death." So I think it's really shocking that a father could kill his own son like that. After all, if he didn't want to deal with Dylan, he could have canceled this visit. Dylan didn't want to go anyway.
No, that's for sure. DHHS has calculated the percentage of child killers, including mother, father, foster parent, daycare staff, friend, or neighbor. But when trying to determine which parent on average poses the greatest danger, categories like foster parent, daycare staff, friend or neighbor, etc., become irrelevant. The calculations show the percentage of child abuse and deaths caused by one parent acting either alone or with someone other than the child's other parent. So the data shows that of children abused by one parent, and in this study it was between the years 2001 and 2006, 70.6% were abused by their mothers, while only 29.4% were abused by their fathers. And for children who died at the hands of one parent in this study, 70.8% were killed by their mothers, and only 29.2% were killed by their fathers.
So I find that really kind of surprising.
Well, I don't find it that surprising except by the margins. I mean, I think I would figure that mothers were more likely to kill an offspring than a father just because they're usually the ones that are in contact with the kids more. So I think it wouldn't surprise me, but I'd say it was more like 55% to 45%, something like that, not 70-20 or 70-30.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers with me, but other reading I've done has suggested that mothers are more likely to kill younger children. And that's because mothers are home with babies and toddlers a lot more often than fathers are. But I still feel like the media gives a lot more publicity to fathers killing their children. And it really only becomes a big story in cases like Susan Smith or Andrea Yates, the really dramatic cases. So contrary to the impression given by the media, a mother is actually like 3 times more likely to murder her child than a father. The incidents of fathers killing their children get a lot more publicity, though. A study in the journal Forensic Science International looked at 3 decades of filicide cases between 1976 and 2007 and found that they occurred about 500 times a year in the U.S. So that seems like a hell of a lot, doesn't it?
It sure does. Forensic psychiatrist Philip J. Resnick has identified 5 major reasons why a parent kills their own child.
Yeah, why don't we go through those and then we can kind of toss around what we think Mark's motive was, although I think we have a pretty good idea.
I think so. But anyway, altruism. The parent kills the child because he or she may perceive it to be in the child's best interest. It could be reality-based. For example, the child suffers from a terminal illness. Or it could precede the suicide of the parent, as the parent feels it would be unfair to leave the child behind to face the cruel world.
Yeah, so can we think of an example of that? It would be like a murder-suicide. What about Susan Powell's husband, Josh Powell, who had murdered Susan, the police were after him, and he killed his boys and himself. But I don't know if that was really altruism, because he was going to be arrested for murder, so that was just kind of craziness. Maybe that would be more of the psychosis.
Maybe you can't come up with a specific example, but certainly. I have a child who has stage 4 brain tumor, and I know the kid's going to die, so I'm going to kill him because he's going to die, help his suffering.
Yeah, I know, but is that really an issue in the modern world with modern medicine? The child would be in hospice and would not be living in pain.
Well, it's also, though, what the adult has for a perception of things.
Right, so if it's not reality-based. True, right. Yep. Well, then acute psychosis, of course you think of Andrea Yates. The parent kills the child based on ideas that are inconsistent with reality, like the parent believes the child has been possessed by the devil.
There's the unwanted child, where the parent kills the child that he or she regards as a hindrance.
Yeah, because that would be like Chris Watts, getting rid of the wife and children.
Or the Smith kids who got drowned in the pond.
Yeah, that would apply to that one as well. Then, of course, there's accidental, when the child's death is an unintentional outcome of parental physical abuse. And then, which I think this final one could apply to Mark Redwine, spousal revenge. So I think not only was he angry about the photos and being called out on them, but it's quite likely he could have killed Dylan to get revenge on Elaine, because he certainly had issues with her. He was a very angry person, and I also think there was a lot of alcohol involved in his behavior.
Well, it sure sounds like that.
It does. Well, just looking at pictures of him, he looks like he's been drunk half of his life. So it seems like it was likely he went into a rage and beat Dylan to death. Dylan's big brother, Corey, said early in the investigation that it could be Mark's way of trying to get back at Elaine. Because at first, he and Elaine thought, well, maybe Mark was hiding Dylan from Elaine to hurt her. But unfortunately, it turned out to be a lot worse.
Yeah, it was way worse than that.
He had murdered him, and it's completely heartbreaking. Anything else to add?
No, I think you covered that pretty well, Julie.
Okay. All right. Well, it's a heartbreaker, though, for sure. And it's one of those cases that just leaves me really angry.
Yes.
Really angry at that guy. TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have comments, a case suggestion, or even a beer recommendation, we would love it if you'd send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com or record a voicemail for us. You can do that on the website as well. There's also a link in our show notes for you to do that. If you'd like to get your future TCB episodes commercial-free, get an extra members-only episode each month, and get a free gift and some swag, please consider subscribing as a Tie Grabber at tiegrabber.com. So we just released a members-only episode a few days ago, which I thought was a great one. I really enjoyed our discussion. It was something that had happened back in the 1950s.
Yeah, well, I think that was a fascinating case.
Absolutely, with a lot to discuss. So I think you'll enjoy that one. If you want to join and listen to that, go ahead and do it.
Okay.
Also, if you enjoy the show, we'd very much appreciate it if you would leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. We would really appreciate that. So now we're going to do a little feedback before we end things for the day. What have we got, Dickie?
I have a voicemail with a case suggestion, and I have one email. The listener has two cases for us to think about.
Okay. All right. So then why don't we listen to a voicemail from Claire? Claire B. Here we go.
Hi, Dick and Jill. I'm so excited to be sending you guys a voicemail. I love True Crime Brewery. I've been listening, I think, since the beginning. And I've also gotten my mother-in-law to start listening. So shout out to Paula. If she's listening to this episode, I love your guys' work. I think you always do an awesome job, and I always learn new things, and I love hearing about cases that haven't been done a million times by other podcasts. I do have a suggestion for you guys of a case that happened close to me. I'm from Kansas City, Missouri, and I went to high school in a town just outside of Kansas City called Platte City, and this case happened in the early 20-teens. And the perpetrator is a man named Quentin Odell, who I went to high school with. He was a few years younger than me, and I didn't really know him. But a few years after I graduated, he murdered a girl that he worked with at a local gas station, and her name was Alyssa Shippert. And then before he was caught for that murder, he also attempted to murder another girl who worked at the same place. She ended up surviving, and that is mostly how they caught him. It was a whole, I don't want to give too much away because it was kind of a crazy case with a lot of ups and downs. But if you guys want to check it out, the Kansas City Star did a big story on it. And it was also featured in an episode of On the Case with Paula Zahn on ID Network, which was really interesting to watch and worth the time. So I would love to hear what you guys think about it. If you want a local beer, of course, Kansas City Boulevard Brewery has lots of options. But there's several other smaller breweries as well, so I'm sure you guys could find something great. I'm not a big beer drinker, but I would love to hear what Dick thinks of the Kansas City beer options. So, again, love your guys' podcast. Hopefully I can get featured on it, and hopefully you guys will choose that case because I would love the insight, and I don't hear about it a lot, even though I think it's kind of crazy and really interesting to me. So thank you, guys. Can't wait to hear from you.
Thanks, Claire. That sounds fascinating. And hello, Paula. Thank you for listening as well.
Yeah, so this case sounds pretty gruesome and interesting. The woman he killed, I think they did actually work together, but it was still kind of random. He said he was watching her fish and fell into the water, got out, and the lady laughed at him, and he killed her, according to Mr. Odell.
Okay.
But this case was proving difficult to solve. And then another woman had her abdomen slashed with a razor. This was Mr. Odell also. He invited himself over to this lady's house to spend Christmas night, brought a bottle of tequila and a six-pack, and so at some point during the visit, he tried to eviscerate her.
Well, this guy sounds like a real psychopath-type maniac.
So that sounded like a good case to do.
I think so. Let's watch that Paula Zahn episode, because I know we have those. Those are on Prime Video, I believe. So let's check it out, because it sounds really like a fascinating case, and it is something that you don't hear about all the time, so that's always good.
Yeah.
Plus, I know we've done a lot of Boulevard beers, so maybe we'll fly out there and try some of the smaller breweries, come up with something really different. Maybe a sour beer.
We could certainly do that. I really like Boulevard Brewing. They do a good job.
Oh, sure. I'm not saying anything bad about them. I'm just saying maybe a different brewery this time.
Maybe.
Or we can go to Boulevard Brewery if you want to.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So we have an email also, and I'll read this one. It's from Marianne with Case Suggestions. And Marianne writes, I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and we have several murders that I would love to see handled with your in-depth analysis. I believe it was in 2005 when Martha Freeman lived in Brentwood, Tennessee, which is an extremely affluent neighborhood near Nashville, with her husband James. They ran a very successful business providing background checks, prospective landlords and employers. Martha got involved with a man who was in the country illegally. He spoke no English and Martha spoke no Spanish, so I'm not sure they did much communicating other than the obvious. But she moved him into her walk-in closet where he lived for weeks until her husband discovered him after he heard him snoring. The solution Martha and her lover came up with was to murder the pesky husband who was about to evict the lover from his wife's closet. That's great wording, Marianne. You're a good writer. The next
I know. I shouldn't have chuckled. It's just the picture of him kind of hanging out in the walk-in closet and sneaking around for food and taking a shower.
It's like Parasite.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I bet she had a really big closet. They were really wealthy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Then she has another case.
The other thing I'd wonder about old Martha here, if she doesn't speak Spanish and he doesn't speak English, how did they come up with a plan to murder the husband? By drawing pictures to each other?
Possibly, or, you know, a word here and there they could put together. I mean, all you have to do is, like, do the motions of stabbing with a knife and point at the husband. And that would get the basic message across, and then you just have to work out the details of the murder.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yep. But, yeah, there's something very funny about the whole setup.
There is. I mean, I know the subject isn't a very funny subject, but you just got to chuckle.
Absolutely. So the next case is one from 1996, and it involved an attorney named Perry March, who murdered his wife Janet and fled to Mexico. We have covered that, actually.
We have?
Yep, we have. That's the one where he killed his wife, and he went to Mexico, and he had that really kind of kooky old dad that helped him out and got one of his cellmates to help with the murder.
Boy, I'm getting old. I forgot about that completely.
We have covered it. I'm not sure of the name, but if you go on our website and search Perry March,
yeah,
it will definitely come up.
Okay.
And yeah, definitely a good case, but we have already done it.
Yeah. It's such a good case, we've done it.
Yep. But please keep calling and keep sending in your emails. We really enjoy them.
Keep them coming.
Absolutely. Oh, actually, I have a little bit of feedback from WSBN28 on Instagram. Shared with us the information that someone has been arrested for the murder of Faith Hedgepeth. That's a case we did for members only, and then I think we put it out to the public recently when we took a week off. So Faith was murdered in 2012. She was a student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So this has been a cold case for close to 10 years. And we've learned that a 28-year-old Miguel Enrique Olivares has been charged with first-degree murder in her death.
O-L-I-V-A-R-E-S?
Yep.
Olivares.
Olivares. You know, pronunciation is not my strong point. But anyway, he was arrested and charged with first-degree murder after his DNA matched some that was collected at the scene where she was found. She was last seen alive at 4 a.m. on September 7th, 2012, when her roommate left their apartment on Old Durham Road in Chapel Hill. Then the roommate returned about 7 hours later and found her covered by a blanket, and her mattress was askew and there was a large amount of blood. In 2016, police said that she was found in the off-campus apartment, undressed from the waist down with her shirt pulled up and her body propped up against her bed. And they also released information that she had been beaten to death and possibly raped. And one notable thing about this case was that there was a fast food takeout bag near her, and written on that was, I'm not stupid, bitch, and jealous. Remember that?
Yeah.
So those were the clues, and people were thinking it might have been another woman who did it. So we'll follow this. This should be really fascinating.
If they have a DNA match, it doesn't sound real good for the guy.
No, he does have several people defending him, but if the DNA matches, it's really hard to say much about it.
Other than it was consensual. That's your best shot.
Exactly, yeah. And Faith's father said during the press conference announcing this that it's been a long 9 years and 9 days, and he thanked God for allowing him to stay alive long enough to see this day. It does give him some kind of relief, or in some way makes him feel a little better that they've found, hopefully, the person who did this to his daughter, because this was a real mystery. So thank you, WSBN 28, for bringing that to our attention. So let's wrap things up for the day. Sound like a good idea?
I think so.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening and for your support and for your feedback. And we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll be there. We'll say some places for you and maybe even buy you a beer.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.